conversation about legal issues that matter to you.
Understanding the culture tells you something about how the society develops its understanding of law.
It seems like they're protecting our right to privacy with cell phones.
This is Stanford Legal
with Pam Karlan and Joe Bankman.
Welcome to Stanford Legal, where we look at the cases, questions, conflicts, and legal stories that affect us all every day. I'm Joe Bankman with my co-host, Rich Ford.
Hi, Joe. Great to see you today.
Great to see you, Rich. Today, we've got one of the most gripping stories we've ever done, I think.
I think so. We've all watched what's been going on in Afghanistan with shock and horror. And today, one of our colleagues, Eric Jensen, who's been so deeply involved with events in Afghanistan, is here with us to give us some of the background. And he has a lot of things that are surprising to tell us.
Yeah. And Rich, I don't know about you, but that picture of people hanging on to a jetliner, I mean, it made the fall of Saigon seem like nothing. It was just so horrifying. And the pictures of what the Taliban has done in the past, particularly with women, I'm kind of speechless when I see those atrocities and I think of what could happen.
Absolutely. And the gender issues are some of the most horrifying. And things have been improving there in many respects until this radical change. But there's so much that most people don't know about the prospects, what were at one time the prospects for improvement there, and whether or not this was always a lost cause or whether this was the result of some avoidable missteps.
I guess this is the point at which we ought to introduce Eric.
Yeah,
because I think we're reflecting our listeners and viewers' shock and feelings. But like our viewers, we really don't know anything like the amount that Eric knows. Eric Jensen is a professor of practice and the director of the Rule of Law program here at the law school. He started an Afghanistan legal education project in 2007, about 15 years ago. And it's been a collaboration with the American University of Afghanistan, really to educate lawyers in a country that really didn't have lawyers. And since its founding, this project has published 8 textbooks about Afghan law for Afghan audiences, has a number forthcoming. It's been a huge hit with our students who have had such meaningful experiences. And again, I think I made a real impact in Afghanistan. And Eric, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Joe and Rich. It's great to be here.
Eric, could you tell us about some of what you've been doing and some of our students and their experiences in Afghanistan and how recent events have affected them?
So from our side, our students have been writing textbooks, critically analyzing the laws of Afghanistan with a peer review committee that is constituted of American University of Afghanistan law faculty, all of whom right now are Afghan. They have international credentials. They've written books themselves on Afghan law. And our students have taken this on as what I call an applied comparative law exercise, where they're really trying to dig into the laws of Afghanistan and develop dynamic textbooks for our students at American University of Afghanistan and law students throughout the country. Our textbooks are translated into Dari and Pashto. They're online with a commons licensing, so they're free of charge. And so they have been used before recent events by the Attorney General's Office, the Supreme Court, practitioners and law students and legal academics throughout the country.
And Eric, you're in touch with not our students in Afghanistan, but with the Afghan students and faculty?
Yes. I, in fact, just last Friday night and Saturday morning, I had meetings with the students and the faculty. The students, unsurprisingly, have been through a traumatic shock in the Taliban takeover. Their hopes and dreams were turned upside down within the matter of 11 days on the eventual siege and takeover of Kabul. So, we started out interacting with them really with the help of therapists because they've been through tremendous mental anguish. One positive thing for better or for worse about Afghans, though, is that they're some of the most resilient people in the world for all that they've had to go through. And our classes started, our law classes started just 2 days ago. They're being done remotely. And most of our students are returning. If nothing else, it's a distraction from all of the concerns they've got about survival and in daily life, but they really wanted to come back together as a community of students.
That's amazing. Just that quickly that they're coming back together. That's very heartening. Can you tell us a little bit? I know the public perception or for some people of what's gone on recently in Afghanistan is that, you know, this was inevitable. And, you know, you hear America's longest war. Can you tell us a little bit about your perspective on those kind of thoughts?
Sure, Rich. On America's longest war, what you usually hear is the aggregate figure of, you know, $2.2 trillion of U.S. funding over the years from 2001 to present. 2,400 plus servicemen have died. Something that drove this is, 60 to 70% of the American public was in favor of leaving before our messy withdrawal happened. But I've argued, because we're academics, we take provocative stands and test ideas. But the moniker of America's longest war, I think, is really a misnomer. If you look back to 2015, over the last 6 years, the number of Americans who have died in action is 66, plus the 13 who were killed in the at Hamid Karzai International Airport. That number, all loss of life is tragic, but that number to me looks much more like a stabilization program than it does a war from the American perspective. The sacrifice on the Afghan side is terrific. 66,000 Afghan soldiers and 47,000 Afghan civilians. So it's really been Afghanistan's war, not America's war for the last 6 years.
This is Stanford Legal. Today we're talking with Eric Jensen about the tragic events in Afghanistan. So Eric, you've written something following up on what you call the myth of America's longest war, on other things that people have wrong when we think of Afghanistan. And how about, what's your number two mistake that we make there?
Oh, Joe, if I could count them. Let me take another big subject, and that is state building in Afghanistan was an utter failure, and state building projects will fail. Americans tend to rush to, when in a state building project, to hatch a constitution, hold elections, and build a broad panoply of public institutions. And I think especially in deeply divided societies along ethnic and sectarian lines, this makes no sense. But the U.S. project, I don't think, had to fail if we had more modest expectations and more modest funding levels. The shortcomings of the state building project in Afghanistan were, one, timing. We got into Afghanistan and then we were immediately, and I was all for going into Afghanistan and very much against going into Iraq, but we immediately were distracted with Iraq. There was military mission confusion over the last 20 years that I won't go into detail about. And then there was what I call development stupidity, including the disbursement of enormous amounts of money on funding weak Afghan institutions that didn't have the absorptive capacity. That's a recipe for encouraging corruption. And I think with more modest expectations and funding, we could have done a much, much better job.
You mentioned corruption, Eric. Can you give us a sense of that? I mean, a lot of us have the thought, well, a lot of governments are somewhat corrupt, and that's just kind of the way of the world in places. What was the level of corruption in Afghanistan?
Well, I'll give you just one example. The Kabul bank scandal, which happened around 2010, was one where the U.S. is actually actively looking into corrupt practices and found that officers of the Kabul bank had swindled $900 million of U.S. Foreign assistance. Just as one example.
Another thing, Eric, that a lot of people have said is that, you know, not only was the collapse of the Afghan government inevitable, but although the withdrawal was messy, it was better than the alternative, that it's going to, you know, we need to cut our losses and get out. But you have something to say about that as well.
Yeah, you know, we'll see, Rich. Recall what happened in Iraq when we pulled out U.S. forces abruptly. There's what is well known in foreign policy circles, something called the boomerang effect. And after we abruptly pulled out of Iraq, we had to go back in and fight ISIS like hell. ISIS became the largest terrorist organization after we pulled out from Iraq. And we'll see if something similar happens in Afghanistan. There are 20 known terrorist networks in Afghanistan. I had a dinner with a former deputy national security advisor right after the mother of all bombs is dropped in 2017. And this is dropped in a network of caves between Afghanistan and Pakistan. And National Security Advisor said to me, you know, Eric, we've only cleared two of the three major caves, but we already have the passports of 15 different nationalities. So this idea that, you know, terrorism has left Afghanistan is really preposterous. And the notion that those networks won't grow and flourish under the Taliban is also fanciful thinking. The Taliban committed to the U.S. government that it would be assure that there were no terrorists, international terrorists operating within its borders. But the Taliban have no power to enforce that. It was a fanciful provision.
This is Stanford Legal, and today we're talking with Eric Jensen about the recent events in Afghanistan. And Eric, let me pick up on something you just said. For some of us, it's confusing to keep track. We have the Taliban, who seem pretty awful, and then we have ISIS, which seems pretty awful, awful. What is the relationship between those two groups?
So I think it's, thank you, Joe. I think it's really important for Americans to understand that while journalists want to separate these entities in nice little boxes, these entities share resources, they share people, they share techniques. And let me just give you the example of Sirajuddin Haqqani, who is the head of the Haqqani network based on the border between Pakistan and Afghanistan. He is also the current Minister of Interior under the Taliban. His uncle is the Minister of Higher Education. Haqqani has close ties to Al-Qaeda. He's been an officer of Al-Qaeda. He's got close ties to, obviously, the Haqqani network he runs, very close ties to the Taliban. He's a senior official within the Taliban. And ISIS-K is held out there as something completely different. I suspect, though ISIS-K took responsibility for the bombing of Hamid Karzai International Airport, they used Haqqani network techniques, and I suspect that the Haqqani network was involved in that bombing, but didn't take credit because they had committed that they would not do terrorist acts against U.S. forces. So it's a very murky situation, and just don't believe that these different terrorist organizations have completely separate, vertically integrated modes of operation.
Wow.
And Stuart, another thing that Bush got us involved in Afghanistan. Obama stayed and implemented some of his own new policies, including a surge. Trump tried to pull us out, but the pullout actually happened under Biden. So, you know, who's to blame for what's gone wrong in Afghanistan and for having made the missteps that you've described?
Yeah, across Republican and Democratic lines, I think there's been an equal opportunity to forge and then implement bad policies. So you're right, Rich, about, Bush got into Afghanistan. I agreed with that. But his original sin was not going into Afghanistan, but diverting attention to Iraq. I don't know if the two of you recall Colin Powell's UN argument on February 5th of 2003, when he was making the case to go to war to the world. I mean, on the face of it, I was sitting with my wife watching this, and I said, he can't be serious, can he? Can people really believe, for example, he'd show a corrugated roof and he'd say, you know, under that corrugated roof, there could be weapons of mass destruction. Yes, there could be weapons of mass destruction, or there could be cows and chickens and everything else under that corrugated roof. So it was really surprising to me that, foreign policy experts bought this. But and both the Republican and Democratic parties were behind it. And so that was Bush. Then we move on to Obama, who implemented a surge that had some problems itself. But soon thereafter, he announced a withdrawal date. Now, you never announce a withdrawal date. This is negotiations 101. never announce a withdrawal date before you've finished the conditions of the negotiations you're involved in. And then, of course, Trump negotiated with the Taliban a very, very, very weak agreement that the Taliban would not attack U.S. forces and that they'd assure that no one else attacked U.S. forces. And then President Biden, has dismantled all sorts of regulatory measures that the Trump administration installed that I support. But why then did Biden feel constrained by Trump's withdrawal? I don't think he did. It was a convenient excuse to get out of Afghanistan and something that he'd wanted to do for many years, certainly since the surge was announced back in 2009.
Well, you've been listening to Stanford Legal with our guest, Eric Jensen, and my co-host, Rich Ford. I'm Joe Bankman. We're going to be back with more from Eric on Afghanistan on Sirius XM.
Answers for the legal questions you've been thinking about.
This is Stanford Legal.
Welcome back to Stanford Legal, where we look at the cases, questions, conflicts, and legal stories that affect us all every day. Our guest this week is our colleague, Eric Jensen, who's taking us to Afghanistan and telling us his experience in spending so many years working with the university there and faculty and students there. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you, Joe.
Eric, could you tell us a bit more about your work there with the university and the law students? Because I think a lot of people don't have a sense of the progress that was made in Afghanistan. And, they probably feel like, well, it was a disaster anyway, so pulling out wasn't, we haven't lost much. But in fact, we've lost quite a lot, haven't we? Could you tell us about what the work you've been doing there and some of the students?
Obviously, I'm in a position where I've been working on this project for 15 years. And a big personal question that I asked, was it worth it? And is it worth it? And, what's happened is a tragedy, but I'd redo this tragedy again, even if I knew what was happening at the end. A favorite Indian philosopher of mine, Ashish Nandi, once said, our inability to imagine alternatives is the surest guarantee of oppression. And what I've been doing with the Afghan faculty, law faculty, and Afghan law students at American University of Afghanistan is really trying to imagine a different future for the country. In that time, we've educated with the best legal education in the country by far, many Afghan female and male students. The demeanor of female students, I think, is really interesting to think about. From when we started the law program at the university in 2009, they used to sit off in a corner, huddled together, a few of them. Right now, we have over half of our students are women. And their demeanor changed dramatically in the classroom over these 11 or 12 years. They are now very assertive in class. They debate with their male student counterparts. They win most of the moot court prizes. They are the best students. They certainly dominate the top positions in the class. And I'll tell just one story of an exchange. So one male student, we were in a class about alternative dispute resolution. And one male student in the class said, you know, our way of settling disputes traditionally is perfect at the community level. And this female student raised her hand and she said, I had a dispute before one of these traditional dispute resolution mechanisms at a local level, and I couldn't even appear. My father and my brother appeared for me. If you think that's perfect justice, think again.
Wow. Yeah. What's going to become of these young women? I mean, now they've made so much progress when given some freedom. What happens now?
So, you know, as we always do in law school, Joe and Rich, you know, they've been trained with critical thinking skills. And they can take these critical thinking skills anywhere. One of the rationales for this program was to populate public service positions. I don't think many of them will be entering public service right now. Before the fall of the government, 20% of civil servants were women. They are not being invited back right now. So they're in a very difficult position. My hope is that many of them get out of the country. And if things do change within the country, that they return to the country and help rebuild it.
This is Stanford Legal. And today we're talking with Eric Jensen. And Eric, we're focusing on right now the students, the women that have had to leave government service when the Taliban takes over. You mentioned that you hope some of them can get out of the country. How does that work? And who helps them with that?
Yeah, I can't talk about this much, Joe, but there are many who, about 20% of our students have managed to get out of the country. And there are different avenues by air and mostly by land right now. It's difficult and it's dangerous. And so I'm going to sort of leave it at that. But some of our Stanford Law alums are working on the legal problems of Afghan students when they do get out of the country.
Eric, you also mentioned that you hoped that they would come back when it was safe. Could you tell us a little bit about the need for educated people and people with legal education in Afghanistan and countries like it?
So I'm going to hearken back to Frederick the Great of Prussia. He was a pretty smart guy, and over 90% of his bureaucracy, and he's sort of like the grandfather of bureaucracies, but over 90% of his bureaucracy was populated by lawyers. I mean, lawyers are just needed at every level in government, outside of government, in business. So I think, you know, if we do return to a more normal situation, there will be plenty of opportunities. I'm pessimistic in the near term. Universities are now open for men. Women are not invited yet. You know, the bureaucracies are opening up, but women are not invited back. It's going to be a very difficult period. And for the listening audience, I just encourage you to find ways to support as you might be able to different initiatives to take care of the Afghan diaspora. They're in tough shape. They arrive with nothing. The governor of the central bank escaped on one of the last flights. His friends pushed him into the airline. He lost his shoe. The governor of the central bank arrived in Dubai wearing one shoe and having nothing else, just the clothes on his back. So people who are getting out of the country really have a lot of needs.
Wow. Are there any rays of hope? And what are some of the things that we can do as Americans to help either the diaspora or to help improve conditions in Afghanistan?
Two things, Rich, on a personal level, you know, supporting the Afghan diaspora who comes to America to look for ways to support them, I think, is really important. And that's on sort of a grassroots level. On a policy level, we've got some work to do. There's going to be a humanitarian crisis in Afghanistan. Poverty is at about 70% now. It's going to rise to 90%. There's going to be starvation. It's really going to get messy. And the trick is we need to get humanitarian assistance into the country, but we don't need to financially support a regime that doesn't agree with some of the basic tenets of being human that we would strongly hold dear to ourselves and wish for the Afghans to have that privilege as well.
Wow. So we're back to a question of sending money, but doing it smart and not just throwing money at the problem, which seemed to be one of the issues all along in our engagement in Afghanistan.
Exactly. I mean, propping up the current regime is not an answer. The current regime has an interest in gaining international recognition. And we should not just give that international recognition away. There have to be certain conditions on that international recognition. And one at the top of the list is treatment of women and the status of women.
Eric, I want to thank you for coming on. I'm personally touched and moved and worried and anxious about what's happening there. And I imagine you must be. And I'm thinking of all the people you know and must be thinking about and hoping they come out okay.
And we've got to continue to create channels of hope for our students, some of whom are in Kurdish Iraq, attending American University of Iraq in Sulaymaniyah. Others are dispersed across 14 countries, and I hope that population continues to grow. American University of Afghanistan is not going away in the near term. We're going to continue to provide first-rate education to our students remotely as long as we can.
Thank you so much, Eric.
Thank you all. And
thank
we'll
you.
See you next time on SiriusXM.
Thank you, Rich and Joe.
This has been Stanford Legal on SiriusXM Business Radio.
If you missed any of it, listen on demand.
Online or with the SiriusXM app.